Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
This morning we'll have an hour and a half, or a little less than that, for the first panel, which addresses energy and environment issue. I'll take a few seconds to talk about part of that context. It's a huge issue, as you all know, where we have an expression in French, tout est dans tout et réciproquement, everything's in everything and with reciprocity. It's a huge issue. Let me address the general context with specific areas, and then I'll lead you to what our panel will be talking about. It's interesting to notice that Kyoto did not lack targets, but it lacked actors. Copenhagen doesn't lack actors, but it lacks targets. Very important that now we have to understand that the issue is in the hands of the major carbon producers of the world, who got together because the American president took upon himself to meet very adroitly and very intelligently with China, Brazil, India, South Africa, and really gave part of the answer to: if the U.S. aren't in, and China and India and Brazil and South Africa aren't in, we're going to go nowhere. Some environmentalists will say, since these countries have taken control, since Copenhagen, maybe we're sure we're going to go nowhere if America cannot move forward and give the example and do in some kind of partnership with the major developing countries. Approach these issues. But between Kyoto and Copenhagen, a lot of things happened. Instruments and in terms of policy as well as in technology were elaborated. Cap and trade, carbon capture, alternative energy use, smart buildings, all things which were sort of science fiction, like 20 years before, and are now in the realm of things we can grasp, and possibly the economy and the market economy can grasp. The second thing is that during that period, what I call le diptyque, the pairing of issues, was pretty much addressed in literature as well as in policy. The technological fix versus consumption. The link between environment and the economy and all its aspects, national versus subnational responsibilities and interventions, incentive approaches as opposed to deterrence approaches, market forces versus policy voids, developed countries versus developing countries, and other similar approaches, mitigation versus adaptation. On the scientific front, even though there's some kind of an embarrassing moment there for East Anglia, where a professor used the expression Michael's trick, and where a very partisan and, I would say, obsessed and ideologically skewed press played the typo of 2035 versus 2350 when one relates to the thawing of the Himalayan glaciers, not respecting the fact that that text had been seen by representative of all the countries, had been edited, over-edited, re-seen, and still there was a typo in what was thousands of pages of documents. But it did make the front page of many newspapers, as if this was part of a huge ploy by the scientific community to make people afraid of what might happen. And finally, Donald Trump, who doesn't like cold winters in Florida for reasons I can understand, but doesn't seem to make the difference between global warming and its consequences, which is climate change. In that context, we're privileged to have with us today people who have already made remarkable contributions to these issues and will share with us some of their knowledge and approach. Daniel Kamen, distinguished professor here at UC Berkeley, both at the School of Public Policy and also the Nuclear Energy Program, is a man who's been to Harvard, had jobs in Princeton, was on both coasts, which is a great thing to do in academia in this country. He was interested not only in public policy issues, but also in the development of alternative energies and their place in the economy. And he will address things that can be done, actually. I wouldn't say independently of policy, but in the present context. Catherine Harrison has also une double formation. She is a chemical engineer as well as a political scientist. She is a prolific writer on environmental policy making, and amongst her many areas, whether they be national or international, U.S. or Canadian issues, has developed a great deal of expertise on the federal, provincial, or federal states aspect of policy making and doing things about these issues. So she will address issues related to leadership and what we call the California effect on policy across this continent. Tom Hoffaker, who accepted to go through grueling travels to get here after two of his planes were canceled, but finally got to us today, and thank you very much, Tom, for coming from Ottawa, is a distinguished diplomat from the United States who is now in Canada as vice president of the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. But before that, he was at the State Department and knows a lot about Russia and Canada, where, amongst other things, he was consul general in Alberta, and also with Saskatchewan, I think the Northwest Territories. And Jeffrey Simpson, suffice it to say, the best journalist in Canada. I've got nothing to gain here. I've got nothing to gain here. And actually disagreed with him many times on many of his analysis in the past. But Jeffrey has written a lot. Still writes a lot, not only as an award-winning journalist, editorialist, chroniqueur, as we say, columnist, but he also has attended the issue of global warming and Canada's maybe lack of policy in the field of climate change in a recent book. And I think these four persons have a lot to say. The first two, because they're closer to me, are entitled to 20 minutes. And the other two are entitled to 7. But I'll be lenient. I'll give them 7:15. So you have the first 20 minutes, Daniel Kamen. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to very much thank you all for doing this, both the panelists and also the organization at IGS and the Canadian side for setting this up. I apologize for missing yesterday. I was forced to go to Salt Lake City to hear testimony over a coal plant. And when you do that for 8 hours, you get to be in a bit of a testy mood. So both because of the 20 minutes and because I just came from a coal testimony, I'm going to be short and blunt. And I will, normally I claim my sort of, upstate New York kind of redneck upbringing for it, but I was just told that upstate New York is really southern Canada, so I'm not quite sure how to parse that, but I'm going to leave it there. But I'm going to be exceedingly blunt. I'm going to say the short version of a number of items, and I'll leave for the discussion and the debate, all of the subtleties and nuances and footnotes to a number of points. What I want to highlight is really a couple things. One is just a 30 seconds of orientation. I have a kind of a uniquely fun opportunity here at UC Berkeley. I run two research laboratories. One is called the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory, and that's about 30 graduate students and postdocs. So it really is the kind of intellectual romper room where we move fast and furious through a whole range of topics, from looking at issues of the grid, which I'll come back to in my comments, and a smart grid or a dumb grid, to developing technologies. We have a 20 years, I've run a laboratory physically in Nairobi, actually physically in the auto shop of the University of Nairobi's science campus. And we've done a number of work on basic science of solar cells. So we try to have a basic science into policy component. And the other half of my laboratory team is called the Transportation Sustainability Research Center. And that group is also about 30 people, but most of those are professionals. They're on long-term contracts from the California Air Resources Board, from the Western Governors Association, from the UN. So this is kind of the intellectual hotbed, and this is sort of the professionals who do. And it's an exciting opportunity at a university to have that many people working on literally everything from cook stoves to advanced solar to life cycle analysis of fuels. And so you can see here we have a small fleet of low-carbon vehicles, so we really do get to do. And I'm going to return to that in a little bit. What I want to frame my comments around is really a kind of a simple point, and that is we hear all the time about the negative tipping points of change in the Arctic, of ocean warming, of species, of fish recruitment, all of these negative disasters that await us in the greenhouse. And I'm going to try to highlight a little bit of what I think are some of the positive tipping points. And if we're going to have any chance, we're going to need those positive tipping points to come as fast and as furious as the negative ones. And I'm not going to get into the East Anglia climate discussion. I actually think that the science community you gave us too much credit, in my opinion. I think that the scientists did a poorer job than you described. Not that that one typo was there, but that the response of the community was much more, I don't want to hear about it, we only have one error in 97,000 pages of material, as opposed to, this was an error, we need to think about the ways to fix it. I spent last week in Oxford at the IPCC meeting, and you know, of the many topics that are not helpful, having a head of the IPCC, however wonderful a gentleman he is, writing a book which borders on soft porn while this is going on is really not a helpful way to move the dialogue. So I think we need a little worse standard. The head of the IPCC's new novel just published was essentially soft porn. Anyway, exactly. We do need these technical basis, a substrate, and I'm going to highlight for a very few seconds what the U.S. and Canada are doing, and they are in the top two, or rather in the top five of the leading places in getting things done. We are going to need a carbon price. For all of the debates and battles, we're going to need a carbon price as quickly as possible. We have proven in the U.S. and recently in Australia that quickly does not seem quickly enough, which means we're going to need these subnational or these international partnerships, be it the Western, be it California, the Western states, partnering with British Columbia. Alberta is in observer status. I'll probably come back to that later on. The New England and the U.S. Climate Coalition with some Canadian partners, the European ones. We're going to need these experiments to go forward. And without a near-term prospect for federal carbon pricing in the U.S., and I would argue in Canada too, unfortunately, despite some nice efforts in British Columbia and in Boulder, Colorado, and various places, we are going to need a push on these things quickly. We're also going to need what the universities on both sides do provide, but haven't quite figured out where to house, and that is true systems thinking, i.e. making the study of energy as coherent or as close to coherent an area as we currently ascribe to areas like physics, chemistry, economics. This is the biggest piece of the global economy, and we treat it as an afterthought. Because the climate battles go on, I want to show one very quick movie, and that movie is really a super fast encapsulation of the climate science to date. I could, of course, spend hours, and in my classes, my students will tell you I do. But if you just click in this, but don't do it quite yet, this is a synthesis movie produced by NASA. This is going to show you the minimum Arctic sea ice taken at the minimum point, which you can only determine after the fact. So it generally comes in late July or early August. We only know it afterwards. And this will show you that minimum sea ice in million square kilometers, and it'll show a record from 1980. And so if we could just run the slide, if we just click somewhere in here, it should start. There we go. And it's going to show, of course, noise in the record. This is just the pictures in the background. And you can see it's starting off between 6 and 7 million square kilometers of sea ice in the summer minimum. And there is noise in the record, as you would expect, in part of a complex system. I debated Bjorn Lomborg right here, and he tried to convince me that the record that was 2 years long indicated an increase in sea ice, and shows you what a statistician can mess up. So this shows two things. One, it shows this steadily downward trend, kind of a linear picture, if you just look down the middle of this, just about a 50% loss in minimum sea ice from 1980 to today, and then there's a hint of falling off a plateau. It turns out the 2008 number is going to be right here. The 2009 number appears to maybe be about here, though. So I wouldn't say, oh, obviously we've seen a tipping point, but we see a secular trend, and we see some suggestions of some nasty surprises coming in the greenhouse. And in terms of encapsulating the story, notice I've not referred to models. I've just referred to data observations. It gives you kind of an opening salvo on this. I know you've talked before, and we'll talk later on, about the interdependence of the region. 30% of U.S. petroleum imports coming from Mexico, that we'll talk about this afternoon, and Canada. And the one thing that politicians have absolutely agreed on, in fact, the only time in my life I've ever received phone calls from two presidential candidates in the same day, came in a very strange day for me during the 2004 campaign, when both sitting President Bush and presidential candidate Kerry both asked for our job numbers, i.e. what are the jobs produced per dollar invested in various areas. And we had been writing reports since actually earlier than this one even, and we just did an updated one a few months ago that I co-authored with Detlef Engel, who is the CEO of Vestas Wind Energy, the world's largest wind energy company, a Danish company. And the results have stayed remarkably constant, and that is per dollar invested, you get 2 to 5 times more jobs by investing in energy efficiency, solar, wind, biofuels, than you get in simply getting more energy from, for example, natural gas or something. That doesn't mean that building out a carbon capture infrastructure, as Alberta is doing, or building out a new heavy industry doesn't get there. And I highlight that because a lot of people have taken this jobs dividend to be some magical, ethically pure feature of renewable energy, which is completely bunk. This is purely due to the fact that we're building a new industry, you're building more in infrastructure, you get more jobs during that building phase. So this is not because renewables and energy efficiency are better, it's because they're newer in terms of larger scale implementation. And the importance there is that for all of the downsides of going first, the issues that British Columbia and California are facing in terms of being an early actor, this is one of the benefits of being an early actor. When the 50th U.S. state goes green, that jobs dividend will be gone. And so this is a feature of acting early, and it's one of the few upsides of building out the story in the beginning. The downside, of course, is that North America is not in the lead. This is wind turbines being unloaded at Oakland's port, and these all came from India. This is the Suzlon machines, and it's great for India. They've built this industry. Most of these technologies were actually developed in North American laboratories, both sides of the border. Here is a similar picture from China, the largest producer of solar cells, the largest producer of batteries for electric vehicles. In fact, China overtook Japan as the second largest producer of vehicles in the world in August. And China's plan over 10 years is to make most of those vehicles powered by electricity. A North American and Central American map shows what I think is the real story here, and that is you cannot see in any clear way the U.S.-Canadian border in terms of energy. You can arguably say you can see it in Mexico. There's a bit of a different case there. But I'm going to come back to this at the end, although I'm sure I'll be out of time. I highlight this because the biggest resource that we have when you do an assessment of going green, of getting to a low-carbon economy, is actually the integration that we can do in North America. It's not the things I'm about to complain about, and I'm about to complain about Alberta in particular, but it is not that. It is the fact that our electricity grid is wonderfully integrated on all three sides of the border, and the more that we choose to build up that, the more we can achieve that job growth and some of the dramatic decarbonization numbers I'm going to talk about. I only put this up here because the United States has just gone through a
remarkable ramp up in spending on energy research. This is actually something that we produced in 2005, when increasing the energy R&D budget in this country was only a dream, and we, a student of mine and I, forecast a 5 to 10 times increase in the energy R&D budget was needed, and in fact, lo and behold, in the spending of CHU dollars, we are actually achieving a 10 times increase. So we are right now doing exactly what we'd hoped for, a 10 times increase. The downside is there's no plan to continue this after the end of next year. And energy R&D requires longer-term care and feeding. So we've got the short-term signal right. So far, the long-term signal is missing from the equation in the U.S. side of the story. Canada also has an exceptional energy R&D base, and I was fortunate enough to be on a Natural Resources Canada assessment team that evaluated Canadian research. The conclusions for that was that a systems approach is required to link both resources, technology, information across North American universities to build out the potential for an exceptional hydro sector, which Canada already has, a wind sector, ocean energy, biofuels, etc. And in fact, this group has been cited over and over again as one of the more coherent studies of R&D. I only put this up as sort of background. But the conclusion was that North America could achieve far quicker and faster levels of decarbonization, growing jobs on, again, all three sides of the North American borders, Mexico, U.S., and Canada, if they took this sort of integrated approach to building out R&D capacity and finding ways to deploy it. California, and we'll hear later on about the California effect, set an exceptional plan in place in 2007. It's been trumped a little bit by events, but essentially the California plan signed by Governor Schwarzenegger was to stop the business-as-usual growth in greenhouse gas emissions. The black shows the history. The gray shows just an extension. Our plan calls for the green curve. It's a wonderful document. It's written with an excellent font on great paper. There's great speeches. We have so far failed to live up to any of it. We have all of the right things in place. We have sectoral targets for vehicles, for electricity, for goods and services for imports. We have everything in place. And there's a huge amount of work going on in Sacramento and elsewhere. But unfortunately, you'll notice if you looked at 2010, we're supposed to have dropped a bit from last year. The only drop we've seen is because of the economic downturn, not because of these things having teeth yet. However, things are moving. As I said, California's greenhouse gas law signed in 2007. This shows the amount of new solar and wind installed each year. This shows what happened the year after it was passed. The number for 2009 is going to be almost 1,900 megawatts of new power. The number for 2011, it depends when two big projects are built, will be an order of magnitude larger. So say what you want, policy matters. The policy came into place and has really kicked things off. The same thing is, we hope, happening at the federal level. I'll skip that one. Exact same story at the federal level I just showed for California is our history of emissions, the business as usual, or dare I say business as Bush, path that one might have been on. This is the green zone that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says that we need to be in by 2050. This is a better green zone than the Baghdad version. This is essentially one path that we would need to get there. Same as California, the U.S. is talking about getting back to its 1990 baseline or a little bit beyond, depending if you look at the Senate or the House versions of this, which one can argue about if they're going anywhere or not. And everyone seems to agree on the 2050 goal. We must get down to 80% or more reductions because none of the people in power now anticipate there'll be a held accountable in 2050, I believe, is the version of that. The issue that's critical here, though, is that the U.S. can do this much more cost-effectively if it partners with Canada and Mexico. Canada can do it much more effectively if it partners and builds out the resources to transport wind energy to the United States, natural gas to the United States, if it partners in the North American region. The Europeans have set a more ambitious target, not just getting back to that 1990 baseline in 2020, but going much beyond it. Very few people think that there's any real credibility behind the European plans, even the Europeans. This is the right goal. It is probably not achievable. If we get somewhere in this region, i.e. we've actually turned the corner by 2020, I will be ecstatic, because I think that while this calls for dramatic changes, it's really turning that corner that's a critical part of the story. I'm going to highlight one bit that we have not yet figured out how to reward. This shows the Moscone Center in California, in San Francisco. This shows the old lighting they had. This shows the new lighting. To go from this lighting to this lighting resulted in annual savings of $400,000. So demonstrably better services with a huge savings. We rarely find examples of that in discussing clean energy. Most of our discussions are clean energy are just as good. Can we get solar to be just as good as conventional power? Can we find local wind or other resources that are just as good in terms of keeping the lights on without having to import 25% of our energy from outside of California, largely coal, oil, gas, from the mountain states, from Alberta, et cetera? Finding ways, finding innovative researchers coming out of the universities to develop products that do this versus this, that's the challenge. The iPod isn't just similar to a Sony Discman, it's demonstrably better, and that's why it's spread like wildfire on the market. And we're not finding enough ways to support those research units to make that happen. California, now a number of European states, have aggressive standards such as every new home built after 2020 has to be net energy zero or an energy exporter. That's the sort of standards we're going to need to drive this kind of innovation. Those are the kind of standards that we don't need to wait for federal action for. Every single Canadian province, every single U.S. state can make its own determination on making these sorts of standards the norm. In Europe, the largest new constructor of townhouses and homes in the Netherlands has set a target over 2014 that every home they build will be so-called home plus, meaning they will be net generators of energy. And we need the rules to get us there. And since I'm down to 1 minute, I'm going to conclude. And my final point is this. One example of transforming this equation requires local action, state and provincial following, and then decisions about how to do it. The city of Berkeley, 2 years ago, noticed that cities around the world routinely loan money to property owners, both homeowners and businesses, so that they can improve the sidewalks, enlarge underground sewage lines, underground power lines, etc. They loan money, and then the property owners pay them back over, for example, 20 years with a voluntary tax assessment. The question is, why don't we do that for clean energy? The city of Berkeley started this procedure. Now 10 U.S. states have passed versions of it. Ontario is doing a version right now. This is now called PACE financing. It's, again, something we dreamed up literally 24 months ago. It is now the law of the land in 10 states that facilitate it. Our Vice President Joe Biden is the national spokesperson for this PACE financing model, where municipalities loan the money, you invest in energy efficiency and solar if you want, or just energy efficiency. You then pay this back over 20 years. And the discussion right now in the United States, and a discussion that should be going on in Ottawa and elsewhere, is what are the things that one needs to do federally so that we can flip the equation? Because no matter how good investing in energy efficiency and renewables are, they suffer most critically from the barrier of the upfront need for capital. This is a mechanism that transforms that. It allows you to pay back the use of that product over time. And because it's an extra property tax payment that you voluntarily agree to put on your property, you're now investing in clean energy infrastructure and capital that you pass on to the next homeowner. So it's a way to absolutely flip the financing. And it's something that federal governments could do, but that every city and every province can evaluate and take on. And in fact, next week we'll be doing a webinar joint between my laboratory and the group at the University of Victoria to do a webinar in British Columbia on how to implement this locally. So I know I've gone over, and I will stop there. Thank you very much.
When it comes to climate change, jurisdictions around the world are both environmentally interdependent and economically interdependent. But talking about the Canada-US relationship, I want to focus on the economic interdependence. And if you think of two jurisdictions that are both interested in doing something to protect the environment, we tend to talk in terms of races to the top. They're going to have a bidding war. I've never seen one. Races to the bottom, where they're going to undercut each other to steal jobs. That's also pretty unusual, and especially between two countries like Canada and the U.S. Much more commonly, we're in a middle ground where they would both like to regulate more stringently, but they're reluctant to go it alone. Because if they go it alone, they may place emissions-intensive industries at a competitive disadvantage. So I think that's the realm that we're in. And in that respect, Canada and the U.S. have had two relationships. They've had a relationship at the state and provincial level, and they've had a relationship at the federal level. Both of those relationships have been dominated by the U.S. in the last decade. The state and provincial one has been a situation where one partner has been willing to go it alone, the states and provinces, and that's made it easy for Canadian provinces to follow suit. The federal level has been in the opposite direction. The U.S. at the federal level has declared they're not going to do it, or did under the Bush administration, and that's made it very difficult for Canada. So in both cases, the relationship has been dominated by the U.S. The provincial state story is a positive one. The federal one has not been. So let me give you a bit more detail. The term California effect is one that was coined by Berkeley political scientist David Vogel. And he was reflecting on a common situation in U.S. environmental policy, but also examples internationally, where one large economy that tends to be green moves first and makes it easy for others to follow suit. And that's definitely played out in climate policy, and we've already seen some examples from Dan Kamen's presentation. And I think there are actually different things going on. The first one is a dynamic of policy innovation and diffusion. And U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis referred to a dynamic of the states as laboratories of democracy. The idea being that state governments, because there's 50 of them, if they're doing their own thing, good ideas will emerge, the best ideas will float to the top, and other states will follow suit. And we've seen that going on. The best example, I think, is California's adoption of a low-carbon fuel standard, a standard that will limit the greenhouse gas intensity of transportation fuels, seeking a 10% reduction by 2020. California is the first state, and I think the only jurisdiction in the world, and this one's a University of California, Berkeley effect. So some of these ideas are coming from right here. And it's spreading. So 12 other states have indicated that they're going to follow suit. So that one was a new idea that spread. I think more common is that situation where the ideas aren't necessarily new, but jurisdictions are looking to whether someone is willing to move first. And again, we're seeing California leading with a number of initiatives. There's a special provision for California in the U.S. Clean Air Act when it comes to tailpipe standards from motor vehicles. And California established greenhouse gas emission standards from motor vehicles. And by the time those were finally approved by the U.S. EPA, which was required under the Clean Air Act, 14 other states had indicated that they would match California's standards. So again, a diffusion among the states. California has specified that the energy sold in the state has to be produced with a greenhouse gas intensity equivalent to natural gas or better. That's been matched by Oregon and Washington. Those are all product standards. as opposed to process standards. And the politics of those two can be quite different. Product standards apply to all products sold in a jurisdiction regardless of where they are produced. That has some important advantages. It has an advantage that you don't disadvantage the local producers. Everybody has to meet the standard no matter where they are. To the extent that the goods you're relying on are produced somewhere else, it also gives you an opportunity to export the costs of compliance. So I think it's no accident that California has led in regulating motor vehicles. Yes, they have historically had particularly difficult problems with air quality in Los Angeles, but it doesn't hurt that California doesn't manufacture the cars. California has established this clean energy standard. California doesn't have any coal-fired power plants. It buys coal-fired electricity from outside, and California is actually including in its domestic, its state inventory, some of the life cycle emissions. So they're counting the emissions that are associated with electricity production out of state. They're counting emissions associated with motor fuel production out of state. And those account for about a third of California's inventory. So those are the things that in some ways are easier politically to do, but tremendously important. Those are spreading. California's also adopting or moving towards process standards, and that's a much more difficult thing to do. Those are standards to limit emissions by facilities in your state. And that's the one that's hard to do because it tends to put your producers at a disadvantage. California in AB 32 committed to very tight targets is moving towards cap and trade, and in particular, and this is the third dynamic among the states, is moving towards cap and trade in coordination with other states. So we've seen the U.S. Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states coordinate in creating a cap and trade program for emissions associated with electricity production. California and other states, and as I'll say, four Canadian provinces are moving forward in the Western Climate Initiative to create a regional cap and trade program. The other thing we're seeing in the U.S. that we do not see in Canada is those green leaders among U.S. states pressing the federal government to set a baseline. They're not saying, we'll do it by ourselves, you stay out. They actually want the federal government to get involved. The California effect has spilled over into Canada, especially by way of British Columbia. And so beginning in 2007, British Columbia announced that addressing climate change would be a high priority for the provincial government. And several of the measures that have been introduced since then are clearly inspired by California. British Columbia is committed to matching California's tailpipe standard. It was subsequently followed by similar commitments from Quebec, Manitoba, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia. British Columbia has last month, I think it was, adopted a low-carbon fuel standard. Ontario has said they will. Manitoba's considering it. British Columbia, Quebec, Manitoba, and Ontario have all joined in the Western Climate Initiative, that regional cap-and-trade program. BC went a step further with its own homegrown policy initiative in the 2008 budget when it adopted a revenue-neutral carbon tax applying across the economy, starting at $10 per ton, moving up $10 per year. And I would be delighted to talk about that further if anybody wants to, but nobody has taken us up on that one. And I'm not holding my breath. State and provincial leadership is good news, particularly in the absence of federal activity. So there's a lot going on. Those states and provinces account for significant populations and a lot of emissions. But it has limits because the leaders tend to inspire a self-selected group of followers. Michigan has not adopted California's tailpipe standards. Coal and oil-producing states are tending not to join the WCI and setting similar targets. In Canada, Ontario didn't commit to the California standards, and Alberta is not joining the WCI. In fact, Alberta's long-term target, which is that the province will return to 15% above 1990 levels by 2050, is mathematically incompatible with the national target, even if the rest of the country fell into the ocean. So to give you some examples of the limit, these blue states are the ones that have committed to adopting California's tailpipe standards. We've got the Northeast, we've got the West, the Rust Belt, not so much. This is a plot of data from Pew showing the number on the y-axis, the number of climate initiatives different state governments have adopted. On the x-axis is the per capita greenhouse gas emissions from energy consumption. It's a messy graph to be sure, but what we do tend to see is that the states with the highest per capita greenhouse gas emissions have the fewest state climate initiatives. California is the winner up there at 21. Among Canadian provinces, the green ones are the ones that have joined the Western Climate Initiative. So again, we're seeing that the provinces with the lowest per capita emissions are the ones taking initiative. The ones with the highest per capita emissions and the greatest projected growth in emissions are not. At the federal level, it's not such a good story. For a long time in international negotiations, Canada and the U.S. coordinated, arguably, in the Kyoto negotiations. The U.S. pulled Canada to a deeper reduction commitment than it would otherwise have made, but the two stayed very, very close together quite intentionally, and both Canada and the U.S. committed to very deep cuts, deeper cuts than other Annex I countries, below business as usual, and it really sent shockwaves through the climate policy community in Canada when soon after his inauguration, President George W. Bush confirmed, was not a lot in doubt, but confirmed that the U.S. would not ratify the Kyoto Protocol because Canada's target was very much predicated on the U.S. target. If the U.S. was out, it made it a lot more difficult for Canada to reach its targets. Despite that, and this was sort of the moment of departure where the mouse roared, Canada ratified the Kyoto Protocol in December of 2002, and then the mouse stopped roaring. And since then, there have been two liberal plans and three conservative plans. That's including the latest one, which is basically we'll wait to see what you do, and then we'll do it too. And virtually none of the important measures, the measures that would actually deliver reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, have been adopted in any of those plans. So we've done almost nothing. And I'm not saying that the fact that the U.S. similarly was not regulating greenhouse gas emissions is the only reason that Canada was not able to make greater progress. In fact, the reason it's politically difficult in both countries are very similar, but it definitely didn't help given how much Canada relies on U.S. exports and imports. Looking forward, there is prospect that if the U.S. at the national level pulls a California and starts moving more aggressively, it will again make it easier for Canada to follow suit. And there's a lot going on since the election of President Obama. The U.S. has committed to essentially nationalizing the California tailpipe standard, and Canada's federal government has said we'll match that too. After all, once 90% of the North American market's going there, what have we got to lose? There's movement toward regulation of stationary sources in the United States, both all kinds of bills in Congress and on the executive side. The House has passed a bill, the Senate, and I thought things were looking more promising a year ago than I do now. But what's really striking is that the administration is moving ahead under the terms of the existing Clean Air Act. They have ruled that greenhouse gases, there's an endangerment finding that opens the door to regulation of stationary sources as well as mobile sources, and they're moving ahead with proposals that, while not ideal, put pressure on Congress to adopt legislation that would achieve our goals more efficiently. That represents both an opportunity and a challenge for Canada. It's an opportunity because it makes it easier to do what we've been saying we were going to do for 20 years. Once the U.S. adopts regulations, the arguments about economic competitiveness really disappear. It's a challenge because despite our current government's much repeated commitment that they would adopt a Made in Canada plan, it's becoming increasingly clear that the Made in Canada plan is going to be made in the United States of America with very little input from Canada. You know, the U.S. Congress is not particularly preoccupied with Canada's interests. And that can present risks. Canada not only will be expected to match comparable standards in the U.S., it will be expected to match what the U.S. sees. It will be expected to satisfy the U.S. that it's matching comparable standards to avoid what are euphemistically referred to as border adjustments or tariffs. Low-carbon fuel standards are a special problem for Canada given the growing reliance on exports derived from the oil sands, which are much more emissions intensive. And I'd be interested in hearing from people who are more expert than me on this one. The threat of that spreading among U.S. states seems more realistic than concern from Congress, because the thing that can happen at the state level is what California's done, which is sort of declaring emissions outside of state to be part of your inventory. So you can then claim credit for reductions that you make happen outside of the state. At the national level, countries are bound by international reporting rules that they're responsible for the emissions that occur within their own borders. So it's not clear to me what the incentive is at the national level for the U.S. to adopt low-carbon fuel standards that basically create requirements for other countries to clean up their act, but the U.S. wouldn't get credit for it. So I'll leave it at that except I do have my 10-second elevator answer from the question that came up yesterday about, you know, what's the relationship. I think to a large degree it's that you need oil and we need customers, but I hope we can do a lot better than we've been doing so far. Thank you.
Thank you very much for two very substantive and interesting presentations. And I noticed how delicate you were until, because you are Canadian, you were able to talk about the oil sands.
I didn't say oil sands.
Yeah.
They're tar sands.
That's it. You didn't say tar sands.
So I recognize
your very diplomatic approach and your great delicatesse, Madame Harrison. So we'll now leave it to our two discussants. They have under 10 minutes, maximum 7 minutes each, so we can go to the room to maybe reflect on what's been said here and then do their own spiel on something else, and then we'll come back to a discussion. Mr. Hoffaker.
Thank you. As a Berkeley faculty brat, it is a real honor to be here. I don't know what people were discussing when they were using a tar word about something, but I'm happy to talk about oil sands. I don't know what that other stuff is. I'll start a couple of comments on some things Dan said. I thought Dan said a number of things, maybe because he never really got to the oil sands. He said a great many things with which I agreed. I really liked the comment that energy is the biggest piece of the global economy, but it's treated as an afterthought. And that really is a problem in how we make energy policy and the position we place energy policy in. It is so important, and yet it tends to be an afterthought. I also thought it was interesting discussion around the need for a tenfold increase in energy investment and R&D spending. We certainly agree with that. We're big fans of a tech fund as a compliance mechanism. Some of you may know Alberta has one. We think that is one way that you can get long-term major flows of funding into energy R&D. Obviously, there are big governance issues around how you manage that. It's got to be managed right. We'd be the first to agree with that. And we certainly agree that, you know, the key is getting to the bending the curve point and that while discussions of 2050 targets are extremely interesting, they are so abstract it's a little hard to see how much meaning they have. Catherine talked a little bit about a number of issues around fuel standards, and obviously it was pretty clear to me she's probably much more of an expert in that area than I am. Low-carbon fuel standards, she's right, a problematic issue from our perspective, but actually also from our perspective, we can see there are low-carbon fuel standards that make a lot of sense, that work. There are others that are intentionally designed to discriminate against a specific product. I'm not an expert in it, but we have a problem with the California approach that seems to roll California's extraordinarily heavy oil into the average and then discriminate against somebody else's slightly less heavy oil. But we think there are ways to do that. A couple of comments about the Western Climate Initiative, obviously all very important. As Catherine mentioned, BC is a member. I'm not going to predict this, but I think it's a possibility that we will also see another movement developing in Canada, and that's some sort of cooperative approach between the Western Canadian hydrocarbon producers, not each using necessarily the same mechanism, but we may see some movement towards them each in their own way putting a price on carbon. Alberta already has a price on carbon, intensity-based for major emitters, of 15%. As Catherine mentioned, BC already has a carbon tax. It looks like Saskatchewan is getting ready fairly quickly to move towards the Alberta approach. And again, I'm not predicting that, but I think in an environment in which neither federal government seems to be positioned to move very aggressively, we may see those Western producers. And it is a challenge for British Columbia that their shale gas resources are getting ready to come on market in a big way, and that's very, very positive, natural gas being the cleanest of hydrocarbons, but it's also presenting a real challenge to British Columbia's carbon policy. I don't know that going in they necessarily calculated that they would be as major a hydrocarbon producer as they've ended up being. I'm not going to talk about oil sands really now because I'm just going to kind of guess that maybe someone in the room will ask a question about it. So I'll talk a little bit about rather instead on our approach on climate policy as an industry. We represent 90, CAP represents 90% of the production in Canada. We are in agreement that moving towards putting a price on carbon is a sensible thing to do. We're not interested in the debate over the science. We're interested in the fact that policymakers have seemed to have made a decision on where we're going, and we think a price on carbon is the even-handed and effective way to get that. It should be non-discriminatory. We can live with the carbon tax. We can live with cap and trade. We think really that some extent that debate misses some of the bigger issues. The hard things are, you know, what's your stringency, what's your target, and then once you have your target, how do you allocate it? Those are, in some ways, the harder and more primary questions. Certainly agree that, like other countries are going to do in their policies, Canada should have a policy that protects energy-intensive trade-exposed sectors. Obviously, that includes us. Call that self-serving. It probably is, but that certainly is our perspective. But other countries are doing it as well. We think it's really important in the same line to protect the country's competitiveness and some sort of alignment with a major trading partner, the United States, where 80% of Canada's exports go, just makes a lot of sense. Does that have to be exactly the same policy? No, it doesn't, but probably you've got to have targets that are somewhere near the same, and you've probably got to have a price of carbon that's somewhere near the same. We think the focus has got to be long-term. Totally agree. It's got to be very focused on technology. Again, a technology fund as a compliance mechanism is something that we believe in. And let me just inject one thing that even fairly sophisticated audiences in this question tend not to know, and that is most modeling shows that the cost curve for abatement in Canada is substantially higher than it is in the United States. This is a real fundamental challenge. Basically, the price of reductions in Canada is higher than the price of reductions in the United States. This is driven in part by the fact that the U.S. has this relatively inexpensive and huge substitution out of coal and into other sources such as natural gas that could happen. It also has to do with the fact that Canada is just a much more resource-intensive economy. It's colder, it's larger, people are spread out, all of those things that we that we all know. Do I have a moment or two left, or am I about out of time?
You have a minute and 3 seconds.
I have a minute and 3 seconds. What do I say in a minute and 3 seconds? Okay, just a couple of facts then on oil sands and carbon. 30% reduction per barrel in the carbon intensity of the oil sands since 1990. So progress is being made. The world is tending to move towards heavier oil. We get compared to light oil, and to some extent that becomes a false comparison because there's just not that much light oil left. We believe that as the world becomes heavier in the oil that it has available, because the oil sands as a technology is relatively new, we are gradually going to become lighter. Not overnight, but we're making progress in that direction. I bet I've used my minute, so I'll stop now.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Jeffrey.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. I want to explain why two things. First of all, why Canada has been a leader in the world on climate change policy, and why it is also a taker. It's been a leader in the sense in three ways. First of all, it has led the world in hypocrisy. Secondly, it has led the world in the number of plans that it has produced. And thirdly, it has actually led the world in the increase of emissions. Now, normally when you're a leader, you take pride in something. So we've led the world in hypocrisy in the sense that no government that I'm aware of has said so many things to its domestic audience as to how great the country is doing, which lies in such dramatic contrast to actually what's happened. The Bush administration, Daniel, you referred to them, at least wasn't interested in this file, didn't sign Kyoto, made no claim to be doing anything in this area, really. So you may lament its indifference or its inaction, but it wasn't hypocritical. It didn't do exactly what it said it wasn't going to do. Secondly, Catherine, I have to take some disagreement with you. My arithmetic count is different. I think we've had 7 plans in Canada. You said only 5. There were 4 Liberal plans, and there have been 3 Conservative plans. So we've had two parties. Well, let's not quibble. We've had a large number. And we've had 2 parties and 3 governments, and she says 5, I say 7 plans. So I don't think any other country in the world can top that record, 7 plans. Not one of which has remotely come close to establishing policies to meet the targets that the plan set out. Thirdly, we've led the world literally in emissions, because since the Kyoto Protocol, our emissions have gone up by 27%. And it shocks Canadian audiences to know that during the 8 years of the George W. Bush administration, emissions actually went up slightly less in the United States than they did in Canada, which offends the moral superiority of Canadians and the widespread anti-Bush attitude that existed in our country during those years. So we've been a leader. We've also been a follower. In a kind of interesting way, often in Canadian foreign policy, we follow the United States. We had interesting discussions about that yesterday, Canada being a policy taker. But for reasons of, I don't know what, amour propre or politics, seldom do Canadian governments actually announce up front, we're going to follow whatever the Americans do. But that's what the policy is at the moment. The Canadian government's target, until very recently, this is the 7th plan, was a 20% reduction by 2020. Often stated, both at home and abroad. I know no expert in Canada. I know no senior civil servant in Canada. I know no foreign embassy who's followed this in Canada. I know no foreign climate change negotiator that I've spoken to from other countries. I know no one who believes that policy was or is credible. But the government of Canada keeps repeating it until recently when it said, no, now our policy is going to be the one established the target by the House Committee on the United States, 17% reduction from a 2005 base. That policy can't possibly be achieved with the policy as announced by the government of Canada. There's something our American friends should know about this. The Prime Minister of Canada, been in office for more than 4 years, has never once given a speech on climate change on Canadian soil. Right? Not one. He gave one in Berlin, gave one in London. He made two announcements of carbon sequestration funding in Alberta, but they weren't really speeches, they were announcements. That's it. Now, no wonder, therefore, public opinion in Canada is confused and indifferent when the political leader of their country never speaks about the issue. And when he does overseas, in contrast to the President of the United States, it's all a big downer. There are economic costs. There are going to be serious dislocations. There are going to be agonies ahead. Now, maybe the President of the United States is engaging in fantasies, although Daniel's paper suggests the reverse, when he says, look, there's a new green economy out there that we can build, that we can access, and that we can create jobs. In other words, he's trying to sell policy on the basis of hope, optimism, and the future. And our prime minister, when he talks about it, it's all negative. It's all down. It's all something he doesn't want to talk about. So we have now turned the policy into the hands of the United States Congress, about which we heard a fair bit yesterday. Now, I think the government of Canada, under Mr. Harper, knows perfectly well that the American Congress is fundamentally dysfunctional. The American Congress has been unable to get a grip on, going back to the Bush years, on immigration, on Social Security, on the fiscal situation, on the country's indebtedness, on its health care policy. So what makes anybody believe it's going to get its arms around climate change? I think the government of Canada knows that they're not going to get their arms around climate change, which suits them just fine, because they will then be able to, I'll use an American analogy here, pull a Uriah Heep and say, oh, we wanted so much to do something, but those Americans, and we couldn't do anything without them, they're not doing anything, so we don't have to do anything. I honestly believe that is what they hope and expect. Because there's no chance of this 17% target being achieved. None. Zip. Forget it. So this is a cynical, but I think perfectly realistic, from a political point of view, out for the Prime Minister. He's counting on the American Congress not to be able to do anything. I think it's a pretty good bet he's right. Therefore, I pick up on the points made in both papers that the hope at the moment lies largely at the state and municipal level. And here I'm doing a Heinbeckerian switch to unvarnished optimism. There's a lot of great stuff that's happening at the local level, and I won't go through what was said. That is at the moment our best hope, to see at the provincial level and state level state governments copying each other, learning best practices, doing policy work at the local level and at the provincial and state level that will help us make progress in reducing emissions, and hope that over time a coalition of best practices can be put together and policies will therefore make their way up to the national level. But I'm afraid that the national level in both countries at the moment is not encouraging, let's put it that way.
I'll give you a minute for you to really tell us what you think of the issue. Thank you very much for this very frank assessment or judgment on Canadian policy. Jeremy Kinsman.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question primarily to Professor Kamen. You weren't here yesterday, as you said. You were doing coal in Salt Lake City. But we struggled here with the notion of whether or not there is something called North America as a community of interests. And there's a difference of view as to identity and public opinion, but there seems to be the view that if there is going to be such a thing, it's going to have to be built. It's going to have to be built by function. Do you think that the energy sector that you described is already mentally there? You talked about smart grids and dumb grids. Then you went on to say that the three-way grid in North America is actually, you said, wonderfully integrated. Is it smart?
Can it be made smarter? Is that a project we can go for? I have one other question. Both of you, Catherine and you, Professor Hammond, you mentioned carbon pricing as being fundamental, okay? You talked about the benefits, probable benefits, which corresponds to what Jeffrey said of doing this at the local and state level. But realistically, all the downside stuff we heard about politics yesterday, the one guy federally in Canada who wanted to run with a carbon tax, he's gone. Catherine lamented that no one seems to be picking up the BC thing. I mean, Tom, I love the sleight of hand about intensity targets, but they're not the same thing, okay?
I didn't say they're the same thing, but in a world in which almost nobody is pricing carbon at all, I think it's somewhat unfair to Alberta to say it's of no significance.
So we're not here to be fair or unfair. We're just here to say what has to be said. But where, if carbon pricing is essential and no one in politics is willing to risk doing it, what happens?
Thanks. So I guess I'll start because you had the grid question, but then we'll go through. And so first of all, I'm going to take the advantage that because I was a newcomer to the meeting this morning, I tried to hold my tongue as much as possible, but Jeff opened the floodgates. And the fact that it came from north of the border means I'm really going to crap on things now is what it means. So let me start with the grid issue in real brief. It is already integrated. Decision, British Columbia last year opened their San Francisco office, and that is the office, BC Hydro, I should have said it wrong, opened their San Francisco office because BC Hydro sees itself as the spinning reserve, the backstop low-carbon technology. There are real problems of stream flow and fish and silt, so it is not an easy panacea, but it is a low-carbon source. And in fact, I'm going to throw something out there that we won't get back to, but I actually do not think that carbon is that hard a problem. It is a hard problem now because we're in it. It is a far easier problem than poverty and inequity. And solving carbon, I think we're going to look back on it and say we were dumb because we moved so slowly when we had so many tools at hand. But larger and growing inequity and the fact that greed seems to be a law of nature is a bigger problem for us, and we're not anywhere near on that. And the reason I say that is because as soon as we get going on actually measuring and pricing carbon, we're going to start to look at what are the water impacts of projects. And then hydro, we're going to get a much deeper and more needed scrutiny. And land use. And I don't think these problems are that hard. They seem hard because we're in the battle. When we look back at the Montreal Protocol and CFCs, the history of the story and what happened at the time are very different. It was seen as world-changing, economy-ending to adopt targets to protect the ozone layer. And in retrospect, they saved the companies money that adopted them. And I don't see carbon as being that different. The grid. British Columbia, Ontario, Alberta already make decisions about what plants to open, what facilities to build, which grid transmission lines to develop based on North American markets. Mexico does the same thing. The U.S. is granting permission, albeit at a glacial rate, although glaciers are changing so fast now you can no longer say glacial. But we're already seeing that integration, and the planning really exists in the region. So it is the resource to build on. The operators of the grid systems regionally know how to do it, but what they lack is what you described. They lack these smart interconnection bits. We know how to build new transmission lines. It simply takes too long and it's too expensive. But we're not making them smart so that when I generate solar on my roof, right now it gets uploaded to the grid at a high voltage line and distributed in a very average way, a way to lose as much of that energy as possible, as opposed to having smart substations so that if a neighborhood generates a lot of green power, it gets preferentially used first, and you save a huge amount of losses, and you make the response times quicker. So smart grid, which, by the way, is a huge comparative advantage of North America over China, because to do smart grid, you have to not just manufacture the devices, which are basically right now made in Germany expensively and China cheaply, the smart meters, But you need integration, you need planning, you need R&D, you need spin-off companies that will make the cool new devices. One of my students is a semifinalist in a competition at MIT right now because she developed an application for the iPhone that allows you to put the iPhone in your regular car, drive around, the iPhone transmits information back to our server, and then we calculate how much you would have saved or spent if you'd been driving a Nissan Leaf, a Chevy Volt, whatever it might be. So it's a virtual electric vehicle test drive. And the biggest hindrance in barring new vehicle introductions is knowledge about what that vehicle actually does. And nobody really knows what an electric vehicle does. I mean, it is a big black box. So the grid is the place to begin, because if you work on the grid, everyone who does so recognizes that end-use efficiency saves everybody, so you automatically bias in the thing we need, and you start pricing out projects based on what you think they're going to be worth, not in 2 years, but in 50 years. And in a world where we're going to need a carbon price, not that we need it right away, we need a carbon price so that we send a consistent signal to industry long term. And I've got one major bone I'll pick with you on this one in a second and wrapping up my answer. We need that long term. And if you say, let's build this coal plant or this wind farm, we've already seen in Montana and Alberta and elsewhere companies saying, I'm not going to invest in this coal plant because I don't know when it's coming, but I know a price of carbon's coming. And at $30 a ton, it is a loser for me to build a coal plant. But when that comes, changes how quickly companies respond. So my beef with you is actually a fairly friendly one, and that is, you just said, you know, industry wants to put up, but the problem is that on both sides of the border, industries put up in academic forums like this, and they shut up when it matters. They always say this at meetings of academics in the Brower Center, you know, what could be a more appropriate place. Then they go to DC, and they self-castrate. And every time they do it, the US can, talks a good talk when they go to visit universities, when they come to Berkeley, when they go to MIT, et cetera, when they go to University of Alberta, and then they go to DC, and they are policy takers. And if you're gonna say it here, you gotta say it there. And so far, it's been an abject failure. That was my one.
Will I get to respond?
Absolutely.
I want to pile on first, actually. Yeah.
Catherine, and then I'll leave you for a short reply. Catherine?
So you asked about the politics of carbon pricing, and there's kind of two big categories of approaches, carbon taxes, cap and trade. I think the tax approach is eminently better policy and worse politics. It's better policy for a bunch of reasons, but the two main ones for me are you can do it fast. And we've been negotiating cap and trade for decades, and we haven't even got drafts on the table yet. And BC announced it. The thing took effect a few months later. The legislation's 40 pages long, not 1,500 pages long. The other reason is that cap and trade thus far has always focused on the big emitters, the industrial sources. They're only half the emissions in Canada. The other half is us. And of course, we buy the products. A carbon tax can apply much more easily and immediately across the whole inventory and provide incentives for everybody, not just the big emitters. Those are two really important, important reasons why it's better policy. It's worse politics because it has the T word in it. And because nobody understands how cap and trade is going to work. And it's going to have a lot of the same problems. In fact, you know, people worry about the injustice of carbon taxes. I think it's much worse under cap and trade. People just don't know it. And everybody believes it won't affect them. And so you get, in the federal election in Canada, the last one, parties on both the left and right of the Liberals who proposed a really good policy. Academics loved it, saying, this is unfair to you. We should make the big polluters pay instead. And I think that set back what needs to happen to build electoral support for true carbon pricing across the inventory a very long way. And on to cap, again, there's this talk of we support carbon pricing. Before the session started, you're saying, oh, yes, we would prefer a carbon tax. But I didn't hear any of your colleagues speaking out during the 2008 federal election about how, gee, one of these parties is proposing a carbon tax that doesn't just target us, it's across the economy, and nobody in industry said peep. Hardly anybody in the environmental community said peep in support of it. So, and what will happen if we don't get there? We're in big trouble. Very big trouble.
Okay, there's a couple pieces that I'd like to respond to. One is sort of the easy part. I'm not. And you probably talked about it yesterday. I'm not absolutely convinced that going forward into the next Congress, the Congress that our instinct is more likely to actually get to this issue. I'm not sure that in the next Congress that carbon tax appropriately packaged and relabeled and they were revenue enhancements when Reagan raised taxes, isn't in fact perhaps more viable going forward than is cap and trade, for the simple reason that at some point Washington has to recognize the size of the fiscal hole and they'll be looking for things that maybe help them address both problems. We could talk about that all day. More to your immediate question, where is industry on this set of issues? No, we don't just acknowledge this position that we, accept the fact that carbon pricing is coming and that we can live with a carbon price through cap and trade or through a carbon tax in academic forums. We are on the record publicly in support of this. We are on the rec. We certainly, in both Ottawa and Washington, have made the point that we recognize this is coming and that we can live with it and that it needs to be evenly applied. There is a difference between that and lobbying for it, which is in effect is sort of what you're asking us to do. And no, we have not lobbied for it.
But you can be so efficient.
As you can guess, like any membership-driven organization, we of course do represent a diversity of views. We have members who actually would be on their own relatively inclined towards lobbying for, and members who on their own are really quite hostile to the idea. So like any organization, there is a pulling the organization together element that always has to happen.
Pardon me, louder.
Some of our CEOs' positions at the extremes are fairly well known publicly, obviously, and a lot of them lie somewhere in the middle. Is our positioning going to become more assertive on this in the years ahead? I can't answer that. I can't answer that question. I do personally feel, in the long run, we would be better served by having some certainty.
Thank you, Charles Doran.
Well, first of all, it's a great panel. Add one thing to Jeff's observations. Canada, it's not only that Canada's hiding behind the United States, but the United States is hiding behind China and India. So it's a little more complicated than that, but there's a lot of hiding with regard to these changes. My question is a very simple one. I would like to hear Tom Huffaker's view of whether the oil sands situation in terms of the needs and so on in the United States and the emissions is a problem. And how we sort that out. And I'd like to hear Dan Kamen's view.
And Robert? Yeah, you want it? Another question? Yeah, go ahead.
Also on that, could you give us, Dan and Catherine particularly, but perhaps the others as well, tell us what you think the U.S. may do with regard to, or may threaten to do with regard to oil sands, and what you think would be the best policy for the U.S. and North America to take with regard to oil sands.
Okay. Do you want to add a question in the same direction, sir?
Yes.
That would be the last question.
Bill McKillop, Prof. Emeritus, UC Berkeley. I've been a voracious reader over the years on the global warming issue, and I've come to the conclusion, I've developed a low opinion of IPCC reports and findings. And so I say thank God for Canada's tar sands and thank God for the Harper administration's posture on global warming. Call it rope-a-dope or whatever you like, but thank God for it.
Okay. Thank you. That's. I think there could be room for a long debate here. That's fun. But we only have 3 minutes left. So I will leave it to the panelists to intervene on the two questions and a comment on the last one. if you want one. Okay. Please go ahead.
Well, I'm going to leave the IPCC one because I disagree very strongly. The IPCC has made some huge mistakes, but that doesn't change the climate science. But I'm going to leave that one there. The tar sands is a huge problem. Tar sands. This is a really monstrous problem because with current forecasts, Alberta could be a larger supplier than Saudi Arabia. And if it goes that direction in Alberta, it will eventually go that way in Venezuela too, because their reserve is just about as big as Alberta's. So this is a very large problem. Each barrel of tar sands oil has, depending which estimate, I didn't show the slide, I only chose Canadian assessments, between 15 and 35% more greenhouse gas impacts per barrel. And those are only Canadian assessments I used in that one. Mine is actually somewhat higher than that because we also consider water and other features. It's a big problem because of the stupidity, not the stupidity in Canada, but because of our network stupidity. And Catherine made what I thought was the most important point of any of us today about understanding end use versus process targets. What Alberta does is to take natural gas, the cleanest of the fossil fuels, utilize it to separate the sulfur out of the tar sands. They don't sell us the natural gas because of the price differential. They use the natural gas to get rid of the major pollutant sulfur, and I flashed over those huge piles of sulfur you can see from space dotting the Alberta landscape. They then separate out the bitumen to then make the oil out of it. And at that stage, they vent the hydrogen. There are two clean fuels which they don't sell to the United States because of the market forces around the huge profit margins in oil. Process standards would allow both sides of the border to think much more rationally about which fuels to exploit. We effectively, through greed, guarantee that Canada will produce and we will consume the dirtiest possible use of that resource loop. So regulation and company leadership can make a huge difference. I want to come back to the question here because it relates to the tar sands question. And that is that Scottish Power and a number of other companies have said they will implement carbon pricing as internal company policy. They don't say they will always pick the lowest carbon project when they choose to go ahead, but it's part of their equation. They didn't ask anyone's permission. They didn't go anywhere. It started at Scottish Home Office, and now it is practiced largely by a research group in their Portland office. But they pick the lower carbon project on their own in many cases where their industry colleagues said, this is a foolish choice, and their profits have been consistently higher in those projects than any other. In other words, by finding ways not to waste, they found ways to make more money. And they didn't wait for anybody. They didn't need to go through this process. So companies can do it. In the oil sands industry, there's been discussions about using geothermal energy and potentially nuclear power to produce a lower carbon flavor of that fuel. That would be a reasonable start. It doesn't solve the whole thing, and you asked the question about what would be the good policy. In my opinion, it is to do this true life cycle analysis. If we did true life cycle analysis and priced out the pollutants, Alberta would make more money by selling to us the lower carbon precursors than going all the way to the dirtiest of the products. Tar sands should be left in the ground. Oil and natural gas should be used. Not necessarily forever. If we discover we're in a bind and we've got to use it, we'll use it. But the precursors provide a cleaner route in the process. That's something that you don't need to wait for federal action on. You need companies to try to find the ways to do so. If the oil sands industry said internally, we've looked at it, we cannot go to the low carbon inputs, the nuclear or the geothermal, we're just going to sell it, that's one route. But from all the analysis we've seen from colleagues of mine at University of British Columbia, University of Toronto, those analyses indicate that the economic gains of using the lower carbon precursors would be a bigger bonus.
Thank you. Catherine, a few seconds.
I think you asked what would be my ideal policy. For starters, it would be that at the national level, the U.S. adopts a low carbon fuel standard that puts real pressure on the oil sands in a way that California's isn't, because California's not buying oil from the tar sands at this point. My fear is that they won't do it.
Tom?
Well, a number of things to answer in that. I guess first I'd say we can't ignore that the energy security piece is substantial, and the Obama administration has definitely embraced that the energy security piece is a very important part of their approach to oil sands, which if you sit down and look what they've actually said, they've been very, very supportive. I guess where I'd probably agree with Dan, I think we probably agree that if you put a price on carbon, that sorts out a lot of these questions, and the economics will drive what actually is developed. We believe the oil sands will continue to be developed. Could it have some impact on the pace of development? At the margins, we would think logically it would. We would not see that there's actually going to be a shift out of oil sands and strictly into exporting natural gas, et cetera. But the carbon price probably does get you the answer to the question. And yes, our members are looking at a whole suite of alternative energy sources going in from electricity derived from whatever source. And of course, that's an open question. Is it coal? Is it nuclear? Is it natural gas? And a whole bunch of technologies in the next generation. You know, we all read about the mining, but in the long run, the mining is about 20% of oil sands production, and the drilling of various types of drilling technology is about 80%. And there's a whole lot of research around, some of it on a fairly large scale now, around technologies that basically require that you put a lot less energy underground to get the oil out. And that's the holy grail, both environmentally and for the economics of the business around the in situ development, is to figure out how to shove less expensive energy into the ground to get the energy out.
Thank you very much. Three thoughts to leave you with. One, complexity is the source of inaction. Think about that. Please try to think, and I'm thinking about Bob Pastor's panel later on today. Think about, in North American terms, energy, environment, anything to do together. I'm pretty sure if you think about that before the panel, we'll come up with interesting things. And thirdly, thank you so much for such a stimulating panel.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.